All right, it's Saturday, October 13th. We're at the Daly Center. This is an interview with Judge Ralph Reyna. My name is Jonathan Sebastian. There's Sandra Campos and Yolanda Jaramillo in the group from Loyola University conducting this interview. Just to begin with, we were wondering, are you a native of Chicago?
Born and raised in Chicago.
In which neighborhood? I'm sorry.
Well, I grew up in the Pilsen area around 18th and Ashland. I went to grammar school, both elementary school and high school in that area. Then I received an academic scholarship to Carroll College in Waukesha, Wisconsin. After graduating from there, I worked for 5 years, and when I worked for IBM and then State Farm. State Farm, I was a claims adjuster, and for both bodily injury and damage to your automobile. So I had to talk to lawyers because people who were in an accident who thought they were hurt, they went to an attorney. And so I had to deal with the attorney to see if I could settle the case before they filed a lawsuit. And being Mexican-American and coming from Pilsen, which is, I don't know if you know the area of Pilsen, it's kind of not the most highest level of economics in the city. I always thought that an attorney was something I could never be, but I was a good student. I did well in high school to receive the academic scholarship. I did well in college and had over a B average. But I thought, well, let me get a job now. So I said I worked for IBM, then I worked for State Farm. And I started talking to these attorneys, and I said, if this guy can be an attorney, I can be an attorney. at that time, I graduated in 61 from high school and 65 from college. I said, I worked 5 years, and then at this time, the number of Latino students in law school were minimal. I think the average, at that time, the average enrollment, or the average at the moment, or student body in law school was, 300, 400 in each law school. There weren't that many. And out of that, if there was three or four Latino students, there was a lot. Mostly there was one or two. I applied, and I found for lack of a better word, a kind of a activist in the education field. And someone told me about him, and so he said, well, apply to different schools. But even before that, I had a cousin who was at Indiana University. She was kind of an activist in the Latino campus, or Latino group on that campus in Bloomington. And I said, well, listen, I want to go to law school. Is there any way you're doing all this activity here? Can there any way you give me a scholarship to Indiana University School of Law, or at least get me into school? Because at that time, I was still thinking, maybe I can't even get into school. Maybe they wouldn't even admit me. And she said, well, you know what, I have a good friend at Notre Dame University. And there was this woman from Notre Dame University, I forgot her name, but she was from Phoenix. And she had she was a big activist in Phoenix. And she just had a high school degree. But she was really big in the Phoenix area. And Father Hesper, I don't know if you know Father Hesper, he used to be the chancellor of Notre Dame University, all the schools, law schools, business schools, undergraduate schools, graduate schools. Anyway, so he told her, he said, listen, you do a lot of talking, you get a lot of good things, but you don't have education. He said, come to Notre Dame and I'll put you directly into a law school without an undergraduate degree. So when I met her, she was in her senior year there at Notre Dame Law School. So she talked to me, interviewed me, and she's, and then she said, well, I'll get back to you. So she got back to me, and she got the school to offer me a scholarship, tuition scholarship for a law school. Not only was I accepted, I got a scholarship. So I said, well, that's good. That sounds real good.
Yeah.
So, I talked to this friend, and he said, well, why don't you try Northwestern? You know, they got a program there where they want a number of minority students. So I said, that's fine. Northwestern is one of the top schools in the law schools in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So no harm in trying, as they say. So I applied, and they accepted 11 students. 10 of them were African American, and one Hispanic was me. So I said, I'm going to go to Northwestern. It was a better law school.
Yeah.
It was in Chicago. I went to Northwestern School of Law, graduated, and became a lawyer. So at that time at Northwestern Law School, there was a professor there. When we were seniors, that became the first assistant state's attorney in the state attorney's office here in Cook County. Under the state attorney at that time was a Republican named Bernard Carey. And he said, you want to be an assistant state's attorney at for Cook County? I said, sure, that doesn't sound bad. You're dealing with police officers and detectives and stuff like that, which I was, because I wasn't really into the silk stocking law firms, So I went there and I was an assistant state's attorney for 10 years. And then I was deciding whether to go to private practice, but then an opportunity became available. I was a little older, I had 5 years between undergrad and starting law school. But an opportunity became available to become a judge. And so those opportunities don't come every day. So I said, do I do that or do I go on private practice in the criminal law and defend, be a defense attorney in the criminal area? So I said, well, because I always wanted to be a judge, because going back to when I was a claims adjuster for State Farm, I came to this building, and so when you're a judge, when somebody comes in your courtroom and they're not a party to the case, or you wonder, what is this person doing in here? I mean, you judges get very leery. Are they checking up on me, what am I doing, something wrong?
Yeah.
So all judges, what's your name? So I don't know, I told her my name, and she says, what are you doing here? Well, I'm a claims adjuster, and I've been talking to attorneys, and I just want to see what it's like to be in the courtroom. She said, well, come up here. So she had me sit down in a witness chair. Just sit there and watch, if you got a question this time, I don't care, if you interrupt, just let me know. She was a African American female judge. I forgot her name, but a real nice lady. So I said, okay, I went up there and I sat there and I saw the lawyers do the work, and then I said, for sure I could do it. So then I said, this is a nice lady. She knows, is this the way you run a courtroom? Is this the way you become a judge? I would like to do it if I could, But now I really thought I was really dreaming, because I wasn't even in law school yet. So, but you know, you have to dream. Set your goals high. What the heck, you know? So, like I said, I was assistant state attorney, and I worked for some real good judges as assistant state attorney. The three of them mainly were Judge Richard Fitzgerald. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a trial judge, then he became the chief judge. And there was a judge named Louis Garippo, and he's the one that tried the John Wayne Gacy case.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was a judge named Frank Barbaro, who was from the Bridgeport area. And they were real common sense type guys. They were, you know, just like Judge Henry, you know, just you can talk to anybody. You know, don't hold yourself above anybody. So, again, there was only one Hispanic judge, okay? So they were one, you know, Hispanic judges, but they want, as you would want, qualified people. So I said, well, I think I'm qualified, you know? So I told the judge, you know, I says, you think any chance I could be a judge? He said, that's, never heard you say that before, but I think you could be a good judge, you know, but, because I thought you were going to go off and private practice where you could make a lot of money. I said, yeah, but you know, I always wanted to be a judge. So he said, well, I think they're looking for him, but let me see. You know, because you know, you ask a judge something, they know more than, you know. Like I said, judges tend to be quiet and don't want to, you know, let everything they know be known to others.
Right, right. Yeah.
But because the legal community, it's a small, you know, it's real small. You don't think as loud there could be. How many lawyers are there in this city? But something happens, word spreads like wildfire. I mean, it's a real small community, so to speak. But anyway, so he got back to me, and I said, you know, they're going to be looking for associate judges, and how they do that is that they put a notice in the law bulletin, which is the lawyers' newspapers. And they said there's going to be opening for 10 associate judges. So if you think you're qualified, you fill out an application, and so I did. And me and about 275 others started to fill out the application. So what they do then is you have to be screened by the Chicago Bar Association. At that time, that was the only screening. Body. And now they have what they call the Alliance, which is made up of 11 other bar associations, different ethnic bar associations. There's the Mexican-American Bar Association, the Puerto Rican Bar Association, the Greek Bar Association, the Women's Association, the Black Women's Bar Association. There's about 11 of them. But at that time, there was only the Chicago Bar Association. So you go in front of them and you get qualified or not qualified. So out of those, I don't know, about 275, they just knocked out about 10, 15. So you still left with over 250. And then you get screened by 10 judges, who are the supervisors of the different departments, like the head of the criminal division, head of the civil division, head of the divorce division, there was 10. So you get screened by them, and what they do is the number of judgeships available, in this case was 10, they find the 20 most qualified candidates, according to them. All right? So then I was one of the 20. So then what they do then is they put these 20 names on a ballot, and the full circuit court judges, like Judge Henry, because right here it says circuit judge. If he was an associate judge, it would say associate judge. Okay? So the full circuit court judges vote. They pick the 10 they want or less. Okay, some judges only pick 5 or 6.
Right. You know?
But what you do then, as a candidate, you go see every full circuit court judge. You know, see, hoping he gives you 2 or 3 minutes of his time to get some who you are, what you did, and he can look at you and say, well, this person, because it could be a female or a male, might be a good judge. So, I was 1 of 10 picked. Again, I was. I think I was the only Hispanic in the group. but then, as you know, at times, you know, I don't say there was any discrimination or anything, but you know, you tend to think, I don't know if you know Chicago, if you're from Chicago, but you look at a roster of judges and you're gonna find 80% of them are Irish. Okay? And so you gotta live with it. And you gotta do so. I said, well, maybe I can break that barrier. You know? So I did, you know, and I said I was one of the 10. And then, like I said, I went to most judges, if not all judges, 99% of judges, they sent you to traffic court. And I was, it was funny because I went, right at this time now, if you become a judge, they send you to judges school for a week. Okay, to learn different things. At that time, I became a judge January 9th, 1984. And so we went to, they said, be at the traffic court, be in your supervisor's office. It was, at that time, was Judge White, Judge Dan White. You know, a real, real good guy, too. And be in his office at 8:45. So, yeah, I was there at like 8:30, you know, while me and the other 10 judges got there. And we heard some rumor about traffic school or judges school starting up or something. So we go there, and so he said, okay, let's read your name off. Here's a manual or whatever, put on the laws, traffic laws. So he says, okay, you go to room 101, you go to 102. So wait a minute. What about a judges school or traffic school? He said, wait a minute, didn't you fill out an application that you could be a judge? Yeah, well, go out and judge. So I said, okay. So I went to my room, you know, and so then when you become a judge, I don't care where you're a judge at, your clerk and your sheriff, those are your prized possessions. Don't get them angry at you, because they can make your day long and hard, okay? And if they're your friends, they can make it nice and easy. So now I went there, and I had this clerk. Her name is Angie Patron, who later on, while she was a clerk, she was like me. She saw these guys, you know, these lawyers, and she was a clerk, but she was in law school. She said, you know, Judge, some of these guys here, I can be a lawyer too, so I'm a lawyer. Well, she was working during the day and going to school that night, okay? And so she became an assistant state attorney. Now she's also a judge. So I says, Angie, now what? Now what do I do? You gotta tell me what to do. I said, okay, you know, just show me the form over substance. What's the form? I'll do the judging. I'll decide guilty or not guilty, but what papers or how I feel, don't worry about it, Judge. Here, boom, 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 here's how we do it, you know? So I said, okay, so with her, you know, I sat there for 3 months in traffic court. But at that time, too, what was really interesting was that was the Graylord area. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember Graylord, mm-hmm. You know? And Judge White's supervisor was a guy named Judge Lefevre, you know? Yeah. And as we say, you know, in different areas, he had to go away to college, which when he got convicted, but then there was lawyers doing funny things with judges, you know, and so it was great for new judges like me because everybody didn't know me. So who was this guy? You know, is he gonna watching everything too? Is he got a wire on too? Is he gonna report us or, you know? So nobody approached you with any funny stuff. You know what I mean? So it was great. All you had to do is just judge and don't worry about, you know, people coming up to you, clerks coming to you, hey, maybe you can help this guy or something like that. I said, and I didn't, you know, need none of that, you know. So in a way that was good because you could just get up there and nobody would bother you, just do your job and that was it, you know, which was, in a sense, was good. But anyway, so I was there for 3 months, mostly judge also. And then because I was a prosecutor and did felony cases, murders, armed robberies, rapes, and all that, even as an associate, they gave us felony jurisdiction, what they call it, so we could hear felony cases. So we went to the municipal courtroom, which is the courtrooms in the police stations, okay? where they hear the preliminary hearings on different felony charges. And if you got felony jurisdiction, you could hear those. But other judges who did civil work, they stayed in this building and went to their civil type courtroom. But I went out there, and you would go to there's a courtroom at the Harrison and Kedzie, 51st and Wentworth, Belmont and Western, Grand and Central. There's different preliminary courtrooms. So you go out there, and you would get assigned there for a week, 2 weeks, and then because then they were switching judges too, because of Raylord, they want to make sure nobody gets comfortable. You know what I mean? And they would change the clerks again. So again, for the same reason. So it's fine. You just carry your plaque and your nameplate and your law books and just go from your robe and just go from place to place after they assign you. And then I lived in Skokie, Evanston, excuse me, and I got assigned to Skokie Courthouse, which is there on near Old Orchard, which is near the expressway and Skokie Boulevard out in that area. So I was there, and then I was there for, I don't know, maybe a year, year and a half. And then the spot became available at 26th Street. And now, Judge Richard Fitzgerald, who I clerked for when I was a law student, I clerked for the assistant state attorneys who were assigned to his courtroom. And now he was the head of the criminal courts division. He was the chief judge there. So again, they needed an Hispanic, but now more. At that time, when I was a law clerk there, now each courtroom has about 400 cases. Okay, and when I was a law clerk there, there were, out of those 400 cases, only 5 were Hispanic defendants. Okay, but now as you see now the population of the Chicago area is it's almost half, and it's going to be the majority pretty soon. Okay, so of course with that you're going to have more criminal defendants who are Hispanic, and they started getting more and more and more, and they said, well, we need an Hispanic judge out there. They want a Hispanic judge all over, all divisions, you know, but especially out there. So I said, do you want to come out here, you know? Because a lot of people don't want to be at 26th Street. I don't know if you've ever been there you would probably be there if you were as a juror. That's how you would probably get there. You know, because hopefully nothing happens to your family or you start robbing somebody that you're arrested. But you're going to be there as a juror. And people it's a criminal court. There's criminals there, okay? So, and they don't want to go there for any reason, including judges. I mean, judges, let me stay here downtown so I can go to Marshall Field or whatever, you know? Yeah. What am I going to do over there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I said, no, I'd love to go. I want to go there. So he said, okay, I'm going to have him transfer you here, talk to the chief judge. Here at that time, the chief judge was Comerford. Judge Comerford was like Judge Evans is the chief judge. He's the head of all the judges in Cook County. At that time was Judge Comerford. So they, do the paperwork, and I was assigned to 26th Street. And then, so I started there for the next 17 years. And then from there, I said, well, you know, I was thinking about retirement. I said, what if I practice law when I retire? I want to see what if I get a civil case? What am I going to do? I want to know what to do, or at least know something about the civil area. And maybe one retire, maybe I just stay there. Maybe I just like civil law as a judge and want to, not retire. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I asked them to be transferred down here, and they did. So I did the last 3 years, 3.5 years, of my judgeship on the 21st floor. So I was a law jury, hearing civil cases. And like at 26th Street, what you hear there, when the judge there, you have a call, like I said, of 400 cases, anywhere between 350 and 400 cases. And you have to manage those cases. Okay?
Over what period of
time? Well, usually you you tend to hear all those cases within a 2-month period.
Okay.
Some are just for discovery. Okay, you make sure everything, all the paperwork is, lawyers exchange their paperwork.
Okay. Okay. Right.
Then you hear. So then you make sure of that, and you give continuance. So, so on a daily basis, you hear about 30 cases. Okay.
Okay.
Let's say 20, between 20 and 25 of those are just for continuance to make sure discovery is done. Then you hear motions to suppress the statement, or motion to suppress the evidence. Then you have bench trials. Okay. Then you have probation matters. Okay. And then the ultimate thing is the jury trial. Somebody wants a jury. So all this stuff you do in the morning, hopefully you can, if you have a jury trial, you can get to it, let's say by 11:30, right? And then do it for an hour from 11:30 to 12:30, and then take the lunch recess from 12:30 to 1:30, then continue the bench trial, continue the jury trial in the afternoon, right? So you're doing a lot of different things, okay? When you come over here to law jury, you get one case. All the preliminary matters are done in the, what they call a motion call, where they hear the motion. So when they send you the case, it's set for trial. And 99% of the cases you get in law jury are jury trials. That's what they call law jury, because no one takes a bench trial. In the criminal court, the prosecutor can't ask for a jury trial. The only one who can ask for a jury trial is the defendant. He keeps saying, I want a jury trial, or I want a bench trial, when a judge makes the decision, okay? In a civil court, they both, either one can ask for it. And that's why the most, and they want to express their case to the 12 jurors, because now they're asking for damages, i.e. money, okay? And they hope they can get someone who's had that type of injury, or close to it, or a relative, or someone who can, you know, think how they're thinking. But anyway, when you get to the civil court here, in law jury, you get the one case, you pick the jury, you hear the case, and then when you're done, you call down to the head the judge, or to his clerical staff. I said, okay, Don, I finished this jury, send me another one. Okay, Judge, we don't have anything right now, but we'll probably give you one tomorrow. So all you're doing is juries, you know. That's good and bad in a way for me, because when you have a jury, you really have to take care of the jury. You always make sure that they're attended to, you know, and they have the lunch breaks, they have their little breakfast in the morning, the lawyers are here on time, don't waste any time. But without a jury, like at 26, when you're just dealing with attorneys, you know, it's a little more relaxed in terms of you don't have to take care of anyone per se. You're dealing with the cases, you're dealing with the criminals, you're dealing with the victims, you're dealing with the state attorneys, the public defenders. There's a lot more people you deal with, but you know, they're used to the system. Okay, so that was a big difference for me. Okay, but anyway, it's something you, as a judge, you just learn to live with. So anyways, that's in a few minutes my judicial history. In terms of, and then, I retired the end of December of last year in 06, and I've been retired now for, 10 months in Cobra, yeah. And what I do now is I do a little guardian ad litem work for the probate division. Where what happens there is that if there's a person who petitions a court, for example, let's say you're my father and your dementia is setting in, okay, now you can't make personal financial decisions. So I'm just saying, listen, I gotta be my dad's guardian, okay, because he can't do this anyway.
Okay, right.
So you petition the court, and the court appoints a guardian ad litem. So the court appoints me, so I talk to, let's say I make you the petitioner for your father. And I say, you want to take care of your father, I got to speak to you. Where's your father now? Well, I had to put him in the nursing home, and he's being taken care of. He needs 24-hour, 7-day assistance, you know. Then I talk to the doctor, or more, you get a report from the doctor that says, yeah, he he has dementia, and it's accelerating, and he can't make any personal defense decisions. I think his son has cared for him in the past before I had to bring him to the nursing home, and his son would be a good guardian. He takes care of his son. Okay, he's not, because a lot of people sometimes you think if a person has a great deal of money, they just want to take care of him and take care of the money. Okay, so you need to think that way, but money does a lot of different things to people. But anyways, that's what I do now. I do that. Then they have a court date, and you write a report to the court. Judge, this is what I did. I talked to this person, that person, that person, the nurse at the nursing home, so forth, so on. And my report would be that the person does need a guardian, and that his son would be a proper person to be guardian. So I do a little work for the Secretary of State as a prosecutor. What they do is they have these restricted driving permits. So if you get two or more DUIs, your driver's license is revoked. So you think about what would you do if you didn't have a driver's license? How would you get, maybe if you live in a downtown and you went to school in Iowa and you worked downtown, you don't need one. But a lot of people, need a car to get to work. Or if they're real bad, they're an AA. Okay, they need, or if they're sick, they need to get to the doctor, they need to get to the AA meeting, they need to get to work. So they request Secretary of State if they can get a restricted driving permit. There's a judge that does that, and then there's a prosecutor like me who just asks certain questions about, their background. And so that's only done about twice a month, 2 days out of the month. So I do that just to stay busy. It was different. Like my father was a steel worker. Okay? He worked hard every day. So when he retired, I could see him staying home. Just always want to stay home on my own. But I did nothing but sit out. Maybe I use my brain a lot. But you can't just sit home and just watch TV. And there's so much golf you can play too. So I said, I got to do something. So I made these inquiries and was able to get these. People do this stuff. So anyways, I'm kind of busy doing that.
Yeah. Right.
So that's where I'm at now. Okay. Your turn.
Well, if I could just back up for a minute. When you were growing up, you said you didn't think you could become an attorney, or that was something that was kind of out there?
Because when I went to high school, Harrison High School was two blocks from 26th and California. Harrison High School was on 24th and California, okay? And the students from there, I would say maybe 20%, if less, went on to college, okay? All right, so I would say, well, I'm gonna try and go to college, And speaking of my father, he was from Mexico, and I think went up to the sixth grade, but he knew the value of education. So I was at the time, I don't know if you can look at me now, but I was, kind of an athlete of sorts. But I played on the high school baseball team and basketball team, okay? And he said, well, you want to play in those things, you got to do good in school, you got to get good grades. Because if you don't have good grades, that means you're spending too much time playing and not studying. So I said, oh, okay, here it goes. So you got to keep good grades, keep, excellent grades, And so I did, because I know if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to play in sports. But, for some reason, I liked studying too, because well, anyways, like I said, I went to college, I graduated from college, and I had a lot of cousins, because my mother has a total of 10 brothers and sisters, and a lot of them are younger than me. So I said, if I can make it through college, all my cousins are going to be able to make it, And I think it was one other cousin who graduated from college. I must have had like at least 50 cousins, Okay. And the only other one was the one I told you about in Indiana, Indiana University, who went on to become a lawyer, and a judge too. So she just returned as a judge in Indiana, you know. So I asked, I said, what happened? You know, why? You know, but you look and you see that you gotta want it. You gotta want the education. You gotta want to study. You gotta want to be something. Because if you just, I mean, you probably can see that you're not here just because you got nothing else to do but sit down here and read and go to Loyola and pay them tuition. But no, you want it. Okay, you gotta want it. You gotta want it inside. And so that's what I said. Well, a lot of these people don't want it, but. But then I said, man, I want to do it because I didn't want to get a bad grade, you know. I want to get a good grade. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's so funny because I could tell in high school there was all these my buddies, you know. We were on the Frost-Off, and I always remember that we were on the Frost-Off, the freshman and sophomore team. And in the varsity team, we only had one coach. He coached both the freshman team and the freshman, sophomore, and the varsity. So he would send us to the girls' gym. So you guys go over there and practice and warm up. Okay, you guys know what drills to do and do them, okay? And I said, okay, that's fine. We'll go over there and do the drills. And we would go over there, and these guys would just screw around. Just fool around, screw around. I said, forget it. You know, I'm like, this is another. I went to my locker, got my books, and started to study. You know, and then I figured out, well, we got an hour to warm up. So I'll study for 45 minutes. And the other 50 minutes, I'll go back out and warm up. So I won't be cold when I get down to the varsity coach or our coach. And so then when I became a judge, my two buddies were on the team with me. Said, we know you're gonna be something because you always were studying. We were goofing off and you were studying. You know. So I said, well, that's why you guys were goofing off. I mean, if you guys would have done what the coach said, I would participate. You guys just fooling around, monkeying around. So I said, I gotta put my time, because I don't want to go home. Now you go to practice, you go home, you eat, and you're tired. And I wasn't that tired yet when I was at that time, so I could study a little bit. Yeah. So when you get home and you're really tired, so I'll be too tired to really study that hard. And but anyway, so I remember that for whatever reason that my buddies told me when I became a judge, we had a little party, and they said, we knew you were going to do something. I said, well, what are you going to do? Anyway, next question.
No, that's fine.
Why didn't you answer the question?
Huh?
I didn't think of it because, like I said, that less than 20% went on to college. So I said, well, let me see if I get to college. I want to get to college, you know. And then, like I said, then I wanted it. I really wanted it. And so, you know, like you said, if you want it, you just keep working. Something good's going to happen if you keep working. And luckily, yes, I just kept doing it my whole life.
Did you think specifically in those terms, though, of that field of law and being a judge, or were there... Did you have other?
No, it was a step. Okay. Like I said, at first I got to get through college. I had to take it step by step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I remember when I was in college. Another thing, I always was thinking about that course and that semester. And because we were freshmen, I had some guys I met because the school's in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is about 15 miles west of Milwaukee, and most of the students there were from Wisconsin. So, and only a few of us were from Chicago. And the ones from Chicago were from the Chicago suburbs. Mm-hmm. You know, like from Northbrook and Evanston and Skokie. And they also had, to me, a different mentality from being an inner city kid, you know? And, but they used to talk, yeah, I'm going to go to graduate school and I'm going to get a PhD. And I'm thinking, man, I'm just trying to get through this semester. How can this guy be thinking about all that? What if he fails this course? Then where's he going to go? You know? So I said, yeah, let him think that way. I'm just going to get, let me get through this semester. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then, so I got through that. So I said, now I became a second semester senior. So now I think I'm going to graduate, okay? I'm going to graduate from here, okay? So I said, now what do I do? I said, well, I'm going to get a job. Let me get a job. And IBM was a big company. And so I said, well, I got a job with that. So okay, that's good. But it was more clerical, than anything. So I said, I went to State Farm. And our boss there, supervisor, he was a supervisor for about over 10 of us, and he was a lawyer, okay? And so I used to talk to him about the law school and stuff like that. So I guess it was a factor a little bit. But then when I started talking with these lawyers, I said, man, I could be a lawyer. There's no doubt I could be, So... then that's the next goal, okay? So I said, let me see if I can get in law school. So I got in law school, and I got into a good law school. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'll work for that. And then, so each phase, I set my sights. But like I said, I kept thinking about this guy in Tawang Bay, freshman in college, talking about getting a PhD already. So I might have had some goals, but I didn't say nothing. I don't want to sound because this guy didn't sound, I didn't like the way he was. But you keep those goals and hopefully you can attain them.
So. Do you attribute, that is the word I'm looking for, but your mentality to do that, to stick with it, to, have these goals and build it up, do you attribute that to any, people like your parents, background that gave
culture,
you that support
to my culture, to the Hispanic people, because, right now there's a lot of controversy with that immigration, okay, maybe because I'm Hispanic, but these people aren't doing anything wrong. They just want to work, okay, because they do not want to go on welfare, okay. They rather work, like they were reading one story during the summer where they're building this wall on the border, and there was this one lady in San Diego who, she was an illegal at one time, and now she became legal, and now she's a citizen, and she says, and someone asked her, well, now you're gonna feel safer, right? They built this wall. She says, safer? What's safer? All these people want to do is work. They're not coming through crossing on my street or walking by my sidewalk to harm me. All they want to do is get to work. But I guess the concept is being in the legal arena is that, but they did it wrong. They're doing it wrong. They're breaking the law. So you can't just forget that. Okay. So, but getting back to what you said, no. So the thing is, my dad, I said, you gotta work, and even if all of us, I'm sure you do, sometimes have a little bit too much to drink, right? and then he would say, well, if you're gonna be drinking, you better, if you can drink, you can go to work. So no matter how much you drink, I had to go to work, and there's there's a certain culture, there's a certain thing at work. You gotta work. You gotta work, and you never give up.
Right.
And that's what you just keep going. Mm-hmm. You just keep going. So, I attribute it to my dad, but I think he got it, and I get it. You see a lot of Hispanic people don't want to take don't want to be in welfare. They want to work. And right now, I had to go this morning on. In the Pilsen area, and there's a little area they built there on Blue Island and 18th Street, where they built a statue. But anyways, all these men hang around there in the morning, looking for jobs. So people come by and said, "I need somebody to paint. I need somebody to do whatever menial task, whatever." And they're there, looking for work. So, and if you go to a Home Depot. Well, the one over there on 47th and Western, there's Home Depot. And there's a bunch of Hispanic men there too. Because people are going there to buy lumber or whatever, paint or whatever you're going to buy, to do whatever they have to do to their home. And hopefully someone will need help. And these gentlemen are there. Hopefully they'll get something to do.
I had a question. You spoke that your cousin was a part of some organizations. She was very active in the Latino organizations at school.
Yeah.
Were you as well? What other like organizations were you a part of? Or?
Well, in college, like I said, at Carroll College, I was the only one.
Oh,
okay. So I was only Hispanic.
Yeah.
So
your own organization.
Yeah. I was the organization.
Nice.
And the same thing in law school. There was only one other. There was a guy from Texas. You know, and me and him were the only. It's funny too. We were only law students our third year. And then another freshman came in from Texas too. But he only lasted a semester because he missed his girlfriend, so he went back to Texas. So you know, that was funny. I looked at him. I said, man, who are we going to leave our legacy to? Who are we going to leave the organization to? He left. But I guess in Indiana, there was, since it's a big state school, and, what's their home? I mean, I don't know, 20,000, 30,000, there's a lot of Latinos there, so she had a bunch of other Latinos to be a part of. But I mean, but then when I became a lawyer, we had there was a few more Hispanic attorneys, and so we formed the, there was one other judge. I don't know if you know, Judge David Cerda was the name. He became a judge in the 60s, Mayor Richard J. Daley, the present mayor's father, was the mayor then. And he made him a judge. You know, and he was the only Hispanic judge. And I want to say I think there was only one other judge, Jose Vasquez. It's a Puerto Rican gentleman, and he was the second, and I was the third. So from the 60s to 84, there was only two Hispanic judges, and I was the third. But anyway, so he had formed Judge Cerda, the Mexican American Lawyers Association. Okay, and so there was a few more now in law school. And or had graduate law school, they were lawyers. And a few more, I think we had about, I'll say seven or eight attorneys. So we formed that organization, and we tried to do some in terms of obtaining scholarships for the Hispanic students who were in law school. So we would have a little banquet, and, you know, try to get people to go to the banquet and sell tickets, you know. Hopefully have a few thousand dollars to give away to one or two or three Hispanic law students. Because at that time, you know, the tuition isn't what it is today. You know, today, I mean, it's a lot of, need a lot of money then. But anyways, that's as far as organization, that's what I did it. But then there are other fraternal organizations I belong to, like, There's a organization called the Wildcats, which aren't legal organizations. These are just Hispanic organizations, mm-hmm. You know. And the I was a counsel when I was a state attorney, to the Mexican American Police Organization, you know, things like that. I did that. But as far as organizations go. But as years went on, you know, like the younger guys, there were more and more Hispanic lawyers, and they took over. So I kind of like faded out of that situation.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, since you said there are so few Hispanic judges, you know, from when by the time you go in through law school and became a judge, do you feel that you had a unique experience, a particularly different experience than any, like I guess the average judge being, you know, unique to being Hispanic in a field that's dominated by, you know, whites.
Yeah, I did feel unique because I think that if you're a defendant, you know, and you're looking up at the judge, and you look at this judge and his name is Fitzgerald, and you say, oh, this guy doesn't know nothing about where I come from, what I'm about, or anything. I mean, you know, which not to say it's bad, but he's got a different cultural viewpoint. You know, but if what I did maybe has something to do with my culture, or at least he can understand a little bit about me. You know, not that I want a free pass or anything, but, you know, give me some, you know, was he want to be judged by your peers, okay? So that, you know, put it in that viewpoint. And so, I mean, there was a few defendants, Hispanic defendants, were young kids, you know, and they would be there with their father or mother, you know, and what's bad about it now is that before you could the father could work and the mother could stay home with the child, you know, and make sure he does his homework, make sure he's at home. But now with the economy it is, both parents have to work. So nobody's there watching him, okay? And you think, well, you know, is that an excuse or what? I don't know. But you would see that his parents were there with their sons, you know, and you could see that they were trying, but they both had to work, okay? So, and luckily this would be like their first offense where they could get probation, okay? And like with everybody, you know, well, I should say everybody, but some people you see, like when I was a, I tell this story as a prosecutor, and when I was at one of the preliminary hearing court, and you see all these young defendants coming up, you know, and you can see they're nothing, you know, they're just big BSers and bluffers. But there's some guys you see, I said, you wouldn't want to mess with him on State of Madison at noon, because this is a bad guy. This is a real, you know what I mean? So as a prosecutor, you would look at the guy and say something, you know, you think you're a bad guy, you think he's that. But other guys, you just don't even look at him because, you know, this guy is evil. I mean, I don't know what it is. But then as a judge, when you're up there looking down, hopefully you can, because a big part of the judge, I think, is reading people. You got to be able to read them, okay? Now, hopefully you do it right. And you see some kid, he thinks he's bad, you know. But then you read him the Riot Act, you know. You give him probation. You know, and if I see you back here again, I'm going to throw away the key, you know. And you're never going to see daylight again. So something like that, you know. and some you get to, you know. And then they'll come back or write you a letter saying, Judge, thanks for everything. You saved my life and this and that. And there's a funny, I was at a Hispanic banquet, you know. I was in the restaurant of all places. And this gentleman came in there too. He was a big guy too. And he says, remember me? I said, oh no. I sent this guy away. So he says, no, you want to refresh my And he said, no, I was there with my son, and you read him the Riot Act, and now he's totally different. Oh, good, thank you. but you get things like that. But what I'm saying is that you have to read the person. And hopefully you can save him. That's where the cultural thing comes in. Now, hopefully with a Hispanic kid, he'll look around, especially when I was a young judge, you know. First, he'll look around, you know. The prosecutors are all non-Hispanic. The public defender is non-Hispanic. Everybody's non-Hispanic except me, you know. Now, here's the only guy who can probably, you know. And he's in the best spot. You know, he can, yeah. Maybe he can do, maybe, you know, he'll understand something. And that's hopefully, maybe that's what they want, somebody to, you know, listen to them for once, you know. But by that point, it's, you know, it's, hopefully they didn't do anything where prison time is mandatory. You know, there's some cases, there's some crimes where you can't give probation, even if it's the first offense. You know. So you know, you do what you can. But those who you can hopefully, you know, quote unquote save, you know, you try. You know, but it's, you know, it's. I would assume most of the time it doesn't work. It's versatile. But if you save one or two, I mean, that's, you know, that's better than nothing. So, anyway.
Why criminal division? Because you said that you did that as an attorney and then also went to the judge. Like, why that interest, or how did that just come about? Or?
Well, you know, it's just, I figured that's where I could do best. Because I knew that. I knew the criminal law because I was a prosecutor. And I knew, you know, because I had ideas as to, you know, what I think I could do, and you know, as a judge in a criminal, how I can handle cases. Because like I said, again, like I said, you're reading people. A lot of judges just, you know, just follow the law and just tunnel vision. And you can't do that. I don't think you can do that, you know. Because like I said, at 26th Street, you have a judge's lunchroom, okay? Mm-hmm. And all the judges would go there. You know, when you have your break, you go there and you would meet different judges. You sometimes, you know, you go different times. But it was good because you could bounce things off the other judges. The judge, you would say, hey, Joe, I got this thing and this problem, and the law says this, and I'm thinking this, and I want to do this. What do you think? You know, they say, well, that sounds good, but maybe what about this? Or what about that? So you bounce ideas or you bounce theories off of them, you know. But then you would talk to other judges, because I would have, now I know the defense attorneys, you know, you've been there a while, and you can tend to get the same defense attorneys in there. And there's a few Hispanic guys in there that when I see them, once we get done with cases, all right, let's take a recess, come on back in my chambers, you know. So you bring them and the prosecutor. So you want, you know, you can't have talk to them by themselves, because then you think, you know, Hanky Panky's gone or something. So you bring everybody back there. Come on back, and we'll talk about it. And they would talk about it. I say, hey, Judge, we got this other judge. You know, he's I think he's kind of picking on these Hispanic defendants. He's not doing that. He's, you know, he should be fair. But you would think of the guy, but he's not picking. It's just that he's. Everything goes by the book. There's no give or take. So I would go back then. We go to lunch and I see him there. He said, "I heard you picking on my people." He said, "No, I don't know who's over here." So I said, "Well, you know, just give him a fair look. That's all. Just give him a, just, you know, let everything be even. Don't." But you know, stuff like that, which you just do, but that's what's good about the judge's lunchroom. There's a story about this place, because at criminal court there's about, I want to say, 30 judges, 35 judges, and here there's about 300 judges, you know, and when they built this place, Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, you know, they asked him, "Gonna build a judge's lunchroom in here too?" He said, "No, no. I'm gonna have 300 of them guys get together."
Yeah.
I asked that story to see if that's true. And nobody says yes, but I wouldn't doubt it. You know? Because you know how them guys are about power. I mean, they just. But anyway.
I have a question. I guess from, you know, from your experience as a Hispanic and just being in the judicial system for so long, and you see the changes going on just in society at large, do you have any advice to, you know, to, I guess, up-and-coming individuals in law or the jury or like judges? Any insights that you think that you would like to see changed or things that need to be worked on?
Well, like I said, I would like to see them to be a little more what's the word? guess for lack of a better word, compassionate. Okay? No. Try to put yourself in that culture, which is it's just hard. I mean, how are you going to do that? I can't be an African American, I can't be an Irish, but take from your culture that you do have, okay. Take that and try to, you know, what you do, how you feel about your culture. You also know that they also have a culture, and that's why when, like I said, the judges lunch room, I try to talk to different judges. I was at 26th Street there, to see about their background, what they did, you know, so hopefully you can learn something. So when you have a defendant like that, you know, of that culture, of that heritage, you might be able to read them a little better, you know. Because like I said, anybody can learn the law. Just read it. I mean, you know how to read. Just read it and apply it. But is there things that you can do, you know, can you be a little more creative, a little more, you know, reasonable, a little more compassionate. You know, you don't have to step on your nose either. You know, you don't want to hurt yourself. You don't want them to take away your roles. You know, but try to feel what, you know, what they're, you know, what they're feeling if you can. But you know, that's what I would like. You know, but that's hard to do. That's a real personal type thing, mm-hmm. And that's hard to do.
I actually can't
think of any more questions. We have a break.
Yeah. Would you like to take a break? We can do it.
Well, if we're not. Or I don't make a difference to me.
Okay.
I think I maybe have some more questions after a break. If not, then.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a little break and then we'll put our heads together.